A warm welcome to all of you to another live session at European Investing Summit 2017. It's such a tremendous pleasure to welcome back to this forum David Marcus, co-founder, chief executive officer, and chief investment officer of Evermore Global Advisors. We have been truly fortunate to have had David on several occasions in the past, and those of you who've been with us will recall just how engaging and differentiated David's remarks are. He truly knows European outsiders, I'll say, better than anyone else. Owner, operators, CEOs, and really is able to uncover ideas and businesses that I don't think many of us would come across otherwise. David has more than two decades of experience in the investment management business. He began his career at Mutual Series Funds, mentored by renowned value investor Michael Price, and rose to manage the Mutual European Fund and co-manage the Mutual Shares and Mutual Discovery Funds. He also served as Director of European Investments for Franklin Mutual Advisors. After leaving Franklin Mutual, David founded Markstone Capital Management, a long-short Europe-focused equity manager, largely funded by Swedish financier Jan Stenbeck. When Mr. Stenbeck passed away in 2002, David closed that firm and co-founded a family office for the Stenbeck family. David really has had a long track record in the space, and we are very fortunate to have his thoughts pretty much on an annual basis here, and I hope that'll continue far into the future, David. Look forward to your remarks today. Without further ado, I'll turn it to you, and I'll be back at the conclusion for the Q&A. Please go ahead.
Great. Well, thanks, John, and thank you for having me back. I enjoy doing it. Hopefully the viewers enjoy it as well. I'll give you just a quick snap of exactly sort of what we do, what we're all about, and then I'm pretty much going to just dive right into the idea. As John said, we are value with a catalyst focus. So for us, it's really all about not just cheap stocks, but making the distinction that cheap on its own really isn't good enough. We want to know that there's a path to getting less cheap. What's going to get the value out of the stock and into the investor's hand? And so we focus on catalysts. We'll look at breakups, spinoffs, restructurings, turnarounds. We absolutely love family-controlled businesses, where we have dynamic value creators at the top who are really making changes and making good investments that are really creating value, and they're compounding well, yet they're trading at big discounts. And so generally when something's just sort of a cheap earnings play, to us it's the most riskiest investment of all, because you have to count on them selling more whatever next year at a higher price, and that's usually rife with a potential for missed earnings, which we see all day long, every day, companies announce missing earnings. One of the great things that I was able to do over my career is take a few years when I was running the family office and go sit on boards, go help restructure businesses, sort of go from being a stock picker to being an operator, helping make decisions, help really do things that would help change the course of a business. In some cases, fire managers, in some cases, hire managers. I think that just gives us a better perspective when we're looking at companies going through change as to what can really be done and sort of in what kind of a time frame. And we really try to focus on areas where other people are just not focusing. So it's not so much about being a contrarian as much as we really think of ourselves as just independent thinkers. Let's have our own perspective, whether people are there or not, but generally we are going where it's just less crowded. When I started investing in Europe many years ago, it was because people were not focusing in Europe. There were all kinds of problems back then, 25 years ago. Well, it's 25 years later. It's been a great place to invest. And I think it's only at the early stages now of sort of the next leg, given the specific individual cases that we see. You're seeing more breakups, more spin-offs, more restructurings, all kinds of M&A activity, because we're in a low growth environment, so companies are buying growth. We really haven't even seen the private equity guys sort of come in with their cash. We're seeing really a lot of strategic buyers doing their thing to add on, bolt on businesses and add product line and services. So with that said, my idea for this event was to focus on an area that up until maybe a year and a half ago, we never would have looked at this industry, these companies, this sector. We would have just said, please stop talking to us. Don't waste our time. And this is in the dry bulk sector. And so you may be thinking, oh God, another dry bulk conversation, because a lot of people are now talking about them. But the fact is, it's quite interesting. This is just a couple of pictures of dry bulk ships. And as I say, historically, we've never invested in this industry, let alone anything connected, whether it's containers, whether it's tankers, LNG. We typically avoid commodity type businesses and very cyclical investments. They're just not for us. I know sort of energy is like a magnet for a variety of value investors. Not for us. We're not interested. We really focus in other areas. When companies have a dependence on the price of oil, commodity prices, I need China to do this or GDP to do that to get real value out, it's just less compelling to us. We want to know that there's things that the companies themselves can do. That said, there are times where we make exceptions to the rule, and this is one of those. So as I say here in our second bullet, as global special situations investors, we became interested in this industry when it was facing death and carnage. And literally about maybe 18 or 20 months ago, you had a situation, and I'll have a couple of charts in a few minutes that you'll kind of see it more, you'll see a picture of what I'm talking about. But you had a situation where, as I write, it wasn't just blood in the streets, it was blood in the water. And frankly, it attracted us to the blood, just like sharks are attracted to it. There's so much opportunity here. Because investors did, prior to our getting involved, this was an industry that sucked in all kinds of investors, all kinds of interesting situations, all kinds of capital raises, ships being built, pie in the sky forecasts, China was only going to grow. Well, it didn't happen that way. And so now you had companies that had to do aggressive financial restructuring, and these were massively dilutive to shore up their balance sheets. All the names in the industry were crushed. We saw stocks that were, this is before we got involved, down 80, 90, 95%. They generally didn't quite die because the banks would always extend out their loans so that they wouldn't have to really just write it off completely. But the fact is the stocks were decimated. And so we make exceptions and look at these kinds of businesses when the panic sets in. And then I say this sporadically, you get to the point where investors are throwing out their gold coins at the same time they're throwing out their gum wrappers. They just want out. They can't get out fast enough. They're not focused on the values. They just want to move on, go home, and forget that they ever invested here. And so when we saw that here, we were very interested. And how it all began, frankly, oh, before I move on to that, I'll go back a second. How it all began was a banker calling us because some dry bulk company was recapping its balance sheet at very weird terms. You know, one set of terms for American investors and a different set of terms for Norwegian investors where the company was headquartered. You may have heard of Golden Ocean. That was it. So the US investors would have a 6-month lockup. The Norwegian guys could sell it the next day. We're not interested. But what we realized was if the bankers were calling us for a company that was going through this kind of transition and was desperate for capital, we figured, well, okay, first they called the traditional investors, then they called everybody else they knew, then there was a list of who knows who, and then after they did all those calls, they called us, because normally we wouldn't even care about anything like that. So it didn't make us interested in that specific company in that case, but what we started to think is we started to get other calls as well, is that we need to understand better what's going on here. Why are they so, we know why they're desperate for cash, but what is it that's detracting all investors from staying, from making investments here and just not interested? And so this is an industry that we've discovered has more conferences than any other industry that we've seen. There's always a shipping conference. There was one just this week in New York. They're already talking about the next one and the one after that. We've constantly asked the CEOs, how do you have time to run your business? They're always at the conferences. In any case, we found a situation where the more work we did, the more compelling it became to us. Here I have just a visual to show you. This is the Baltic Dry Index. So this is just an index of sort of a blended rate of all ship sizes and an amalgamation of day rates into an index. You can see up to 2008, pie in the sky, just straight up as though it would never end. Well, in the financial crisis, it ended. But it ended for many industries, but this one especially was down over 90% from the peak to the trough. And then over the next years, now almost 9 years already, you've had fits and starts along the way. But this is really a boom and bust scenario. The problem with this chart is because the scale in 08 made it go so big, the nuance of the scale in 13, 14, 15, it doesn't really look like much, but frankly, the moves are also dramatic. And that was during the years where China was really perceived as growing forever, and shipping owners were building new ships and ordering them faster than ever before. This is just a quick slide snapshot of some of the stocks I'll talk about in just a few minutes. SB is Safe Bulkers. It's controlled by a Greek shipping family. Salt is Scorpio Bulkers, similarly. And then Navios Maritime Marine, again, main shareholders from Greece. You can see the just implosion that occurred. And here you can focus on what, as I just said a few minutes ago, 14, 15, China started to slow down. Day rates came down. But more than that, the perception changed very rapidly of the future for this industry. Why? The ship orders were so, the owners were ordering so many ships and they hadn't even been delivered yet, but China was slowing down. So just as the Chinese slowdown was starting to manifest itself, it was just the front end of deliveries. So you just had an explosion of supply and a decline in demand, sort of the worst potential. This just shows you the dry bulk index versus some of the stocks. And you can see even in the last year or two, you've seen a bounce in the index, but the underlying stocks have, while they've moved substantially, they really haven't moved enough to really go back to where they should be appropriately valued. And so what happens when spot rates go below certain asset levels, it will impact the day rates and the cash flows. Companies started to break covenants. So then the bankers were nervous. All kinds of German banks were lenders to this industry. So just it was sort of the first domino fell, and very rapidly it just started spiraling. And again, this all predates our getting involved. A lot of these charts I've put in here for anybody that's going to get the slides, so you can look at them later on. I won't take you through every bar in the graph. So the lead-in is this. During the crisis, we saw the following. Asset values at historically trough levels. You had five-year-old Capesize trading at 50% discounts to the 20-year average. You had spot rates for or secondhand vessels trading sort of in the market at 35, 40% discounts. So 55 to 60% of new build prices. You had a point in January of 16 when day rates hit 1500 per day. This is so far below just daily operating costs for ships. So what does that do? The ship owners start to say, well, wait a minute, it's just so uneconomic. They can handle selling, chartering out their ships below cost just to keep the wheels moving, keep everything going, because it costs too much money to sort of put your ship out in the middle of no place and sort of decommission it for a few months. You can't just decommission it and recommission it. You have to commit to quite a number of months because of the nature of the whole process and the cost. So generally, even if they're running below their operating costs, they'll keep going as long as they can, because they're always hoping, well, it's going to turn. Well, in any case, it didn't turn. And so what started to happen was the older ships started to be scrapped. You started to see the dry dock costs, the maintenance costs were just adding up for ships that were not being utilized at all, because they're sort of alive, but they're not being chartered out. So then you start cutting your price and cutting and cutting. And the net of it all is that scrapping really started to grow. So you had a situation where older ships, less economically efficient ships, were being sent to the old scrap heap. And that was really changing the supply of capacity really significantly. And so you got to a point where you had a negative implied level of capacity growth. It shrunk. Just you had an inflection point between demand and supply for a very brief period, because it was sort of on fire and people were just scrapping aggressively. As I point out here, about 8% of the total fleet was sent to the scrapper. You had a much reduced number of ships. Companies that we got to know were canceling orders, leaving, you know, $5, $6, $7, $10 million cash deposits on the table with the shipyard to just walk away from ships, because their view was it was better to lose $8 million than to pay the rest of the balance of the ship and then have to manage it. And so just I'm trying to paint a picture here of just sheer absolute carnage, devastation, panic. And so in early 16, it was just sort of an absolute nightmare. This chart here just shows you historical asset values. Again, 08, things just gapped up. Since then, they're trading below. I mean, we're trading not just at levels from 2000. If you took this chart all the way back, you'd see you're replicating the levels of 1980. You're really trading at levels that we haven't seen in quite some time. So for us, plowing forth to the next level, what I'll tell you is that the first conference that I went to in this industry was in early 16. It was absolutely amazing. We were there. I was there with Thomas O, one of our senior analysts who's worked on this industry with me from the beginning. And Tommy and I were there, and we were just amazed. Why were we amazed? We were the only people smiling. People were practically in tears. The bankers, the ship owners, the CEOs of the companies, the CFOs especially. There was just sheer, you could feel it in the room. It was unbelievable. And so we walked around the meetings. We started to meet the owners, the main shareholders, the operators. And what we realized was it was, I would say, quite simple. If you had a young fleet of ships, good cost controls, solid management, or you had an old fleet, bad controls and weak managers, you were both trading at about the same percent of net asset value, meaning the market was not discriminated good between good and bad. It was just saying, forget it, it's all dead. And on my third bullet point here, I have a phrase where I say nevermore versus evermore. And it's just a simple anecdotal story. There is a company called Star Bulk. The CEO, we were going to see him, and he literally, before we even said hello, he saw my name tag at the conference. He said, Evermore? I said, yes. He says, I bet you've never, ever invested in this sector at all. You probably never even looked at it before recently. Like, you're correct. What are you, a mind reader? And he says, no. He said, if you had invested any time before today, your name would actually be Nevermore. And his point was this industry had just had crushed everybody. So after that, we shook hands and said hello. We literally hadn't even sat down yet. And so that's when we knew we were onto something. It couldn't be that the whole industry would go away. Just couldn't be. And so the key for us was to figure out who were the players that would survive, who were trading at the cheapest levels, who were going to be recapping their balance sheets, and how could we kind of weasel our way into not just buying the stocks in the market. Was there an opportunity to participate in the recaps? That's where you can find really compelling opportunities. And so, as I say, this was just an affirmation of this just devastation. And so ultimately, we went from being, as I say here in almost the last bullet, newbies, not knowing anything about the industry, we went to the other end. We got to the point where we were helping companies recap their balance sheets. We were helping them really restructure so that they could push their liquidity window out and give them sort of a chance to cut their costs, refocus their business, scrap the ships that needed to be scrapped here and there, maybe even make a sale, but more than anything, buy assets. And we were excited about the opportunity to buy secondhand ships, the companies that would survive and be able to just kind of take away the lowest hanging opportunity from the more distressed sellers. And so we had opportunities where we saw companies doing recap after recap after recap after recap. And so that was all in one company, by the way, all those recaps. And so what we felt was that we have to figure out sort of what are the insiders doing? And so the first investment we made in this industry, just going to see what my next slide is. Oh yeah, there it is. So the first, we own all four of these stocks. These are my ideas. Finally, on page 12, I'm getting to my ideas. Scorpio Bulkers is the first company we bought. In March of 16, they were raising equity. And now, why were these companies raising equity and not debt? Well, simple. The banks just couldn't stomach giving them any more funding. It was just not even recaps and restructuring with the debt. The banks just wanted to see more equity come in. These market caps had imploded. Some of these stocks, as I said earlier, were down over 90%. And I have some more specific slides on Scorpio that I'll get into the story a little more in depth in a couple of minutes. But basically, in March of 16, we invested when the insiders were investing. And then in June of 16, they were raising equity again. And we felt it was compelling because part of the money was going to be used to buy additional ships. Not new ones is the key. Used ones. Safe Bulkers. To me, Safe is such a great story. And by the way, we still own these. So my whole pitch here is that yes, we've made money in two of these names. One, and the other two were about at our cost, and I'll get into the specifics. But we think it's still just early in the process. Safe Bulkers in December was looking to raise money, not to recap their balance sheet, but they saw what we saw, a wonderful opportunity to buy secondhand ships at very attractive prices. You had certain German banks desperate to sell the ships that they now controlled. You had operating companies that were kind of careening towards the end, needed to lighten their burden. So Safe wanted to buy ships. Their stock had been down well over 90%. It was down to, I think, $1.43 or $1.45. Actually, no, it was $1.64 per share a few days before we talked to them. Of course, over the next few days, it's $1.40 something. They were going to raise 20 million. Now, it doesn't sound like a lot, but their market cap was down to, I think, 125 million. It really had been decimated. Their view was, though, the price of secondhand ships was so compelling, how could we not do it? And so, frankly, we were a price setter on their deal. They couldn't raise the 20. I think we put $6 million up. They only got to 17. But here was the most compelling part. We told them we would only invest if it was at $1.10 per share. Remember, the prior day was a dollar 40 something. But I told them I wouldn't invest if it was a dollar 9. And why is that? I explained to them, I told them the story about Dexter shoes with Buffett. You know, that at every year, I go to the meeting every year. I've been there now 18 years. This will be my 19th next May. But basically, you know, he spent what, 350 or 400 million for Dexter shoes, but he did it with Berkshire stock. And so he's always talking about, it's not the 350 or 400 million he put in, it's the billions of dollars that stock became. And my lecture to the management of Safe was, you want to buy ships. It's not just the $20 million you're raising and the money you'll borrow to from the banks that will lend you money on some of these ships. It's this equity you're giving up. You're cutting the price so low. So my point was that $1.09 tells me you have no discipline. You're not going to stop at any point, and you're really going to overpay for things. And so they priced it at $1.10. So at that point, we owned 5% of the company. The punchline is it's about $3 today. It worked extremely well. Navios is trading roughly around where we started buying it. There's a handful of Navios companies that are all kind of connected through one main owner. We own shares in two of them, but in the dry bulk, just this one. We also own shares in their container company. And then the fourth one on the list is Songa Bulk. Songa is a Norwegian company that was created for one reason: take advantage of an opportunity. I think before these guys started this public company, they were going to probably run a private entity or a fund even. So here was our chance to partner with some of the smartest investors in the industry. The main shareholder is a guy named Arne Blisted, one of the wealthiest men in Norway, from a variety of businesses, but especially in shipping related. The CEO is Herman Bylund. He's the former CEO of Golden Ocean. These guys have been around forever. They understand well the industry and how to take advantage of it. And their idea was, there is, like, as we thought, there's so much devastation. Let's raise money. Let's buy ships from, not new ships. I mean, they could be new ships from the shipyard, but they were not creating new capacity. So when people walk away from their deposits, the shipyard now has that ship. They still have to sell it. They're not going to stop building it. They might slow down the process. So you can actually buy new ships at the value of secondhand ships because the carnage was so crazy. So the idea for Songa is to be a limited life company. Buy ships, manage them well, manage them the most efficiently, keep the fleet extremely young, and ultimately exit. They're taking advantage of such dislocation in pricing. So these four represent sort of the core of our investment in this sector. And just in the case of Scorpio, I have a slide here just to show you how the stock sort of imploded over the last few years. What you can't see because the scale is so large is that it has gone from $3 to almost $7.50 now. But the key was that the insiders were putting in a significant chunk of capital. They were buying almost a quarter of the deal. So the key is always to come in on the dilution for everybody else, meaning all the prior investors are being diluted. We're not. So they raised an enormous amount of capital. The prior investors get really crushed unless they re-up on the deal. What we have to understand is, are we coming in the last recap? We don't want to be the second to last or the third to last. And what Scorpio did, which we thought was fascinating, was instead of going to the banks and saying, give us better terms, what is it going to take for better terms? And the bank saying, well, we'll raise some equity. They kind of took an unusual tactic, which was, their view was, let's raise the money first. Let's not go threaten the banks like everybody else is doing, that, you know, we'll go bust unless they work with us. They went out, they raised the money. Then they went to the banks and said, look, we just, you know, buffed up our balance sheet. We want you to work with us. The banks were extremely, I think, appreciative that they weren't being shown a gun to their head. And the banks worked with the company. A few months later, they decided they would increase the amount offered. It was about the same level. We participated again. The bulk of that was just to, again, solidify the balance sheet, just in case things continue to take longer, but also with an eye towards perhaps buying a ship or two here or there if it was attractive enough. They actually ultimately bought their, went back to the shipyard that had some of the ships they had walked away from, and they renegotiated to buy two of their own ships at much better prices. Very smart management team here, very aggressive, and they had gotten into trouble because they actually formulated this company back in 13. Their timing couldn't have been worse, frankly, to create the business. Our idea isn't, we would never have invested at the beginning, but the fact is we came in at the later stages because there was just so much, as I said before, I know I've said it 100 times already, decimation. But we came in at a level that was, as I'll show you on the next page here, towards the bottom, at $3 a share, we were creating this company at about 35% of their net asset value. I mean, it was very compelling. You were getting this at, just over a third of replacement cost. It's really, really amazing what we were able to invest in here. So ultimately, the company did renegotiate the debt covenants. They adjusted their management contracts to make it more aligned with shareholders. But ultimately, the business has picked up enough that even though they have significant waivers, they actually just recently, I think about a month ago, went to the banks and said, you can unwaive the waivers, meaning we want to go back to the amortization schedule and we're going to start repaying our debt. Just to show you how far they've come in really the span of less than 2 years. But we love about Scorpio is that they are that way. They're not trying to sort of milk it. They're not saying, oh, the banks gave us this runway, let's just leave it at that. Their view is, no, they gave us the runway when we needed it. We don't need it anymore. In fact, if anything, Scorpio is now talking about getting to the point where they'd start paying dividends. And they have the best balance sheet in the industry, solid. They have one of the youngest fleets. They have the best balance sheet. They have the ability probably to pay dividends not in the too distant future. So we really have come a long way in a short period of time with these companies, but it's still early days. And so now I won't belabor Scorpio. The last thing I'll just say is that just, I think it was earlier this week, management was buying shares in the company just around these levels. We've nibbled recently. We own about 6.5 or 7% of Scorpio. I think we own approximately 11% of Songa Bulk. We own, I think, about 5 of Navios and maybe 3% of Safe Bulkers, roughly. And so we're substantial shareholders here. Again, for a firm that had no investment in this sector ever before, a year and a half ago. And so where are we now? The low-hanging fruit, the easy money, okay, some of that's been made. But I would say now the opportunity is in what I'll call the medium-hanging fruit. We don't have to stretch to the top of the trees. The fact is, so the early, just the recap, helping these companies kind of exist. We were part of that in a couple of cases. In other cases, we chose not to do it. Others did it. But the fact is, okay, so now they're there. Rates have moved up. You're seeing things picking up in China, for example. I think steel production in China, I just read, is at record levels already. Again, well, they need iron ore to do that. So they start bringing more iron ore. That's good for the dry bulk industry. But the fact is, and I think the guy who said it the best was Herman Bylung, who's the CEO of Songa Bulk, not at the conference this week in New York, the one 3 months ago in New York. he was on a panel and he said, and then the audience, it was guys like us, but it was also a lot of the managements of the other companies. And he basically said, let's not get stupid this time to the other CEOs. We know that, you know, ordering new ships is the thing that kills because it creates too much supply. There's plenty to do for all of us here. Please don't get stupid. He must have said it 3 or 4 times. And at first people were kind of chuckling. I think then ultimately it was sinking into people. Yeah, it's not, it isn't rocket science. You know, you don't have to get too carried away here. There's a wonderful opportunity for the participants, but they have to be smart about it, because what happens is one ship owner says, I could order 2 new ships, who cares? And then that guy says 2, and that guy says 3, and then before you know it, there's 30 new ships. And they're all coming on at the same time. And so they have to be smarter about it. We track all of those aspects. But the fact is, we're buying assets ridiculously cheap, even today. We're getting these stocks trading at discounts that you normally just don't see. And so to take advantage of these commodity-type businesses when they go through this death and carnage phase, that's exciting to us. So while it is a new area for us, it's something that has worked so far, and we think that it's still early in the game. As I point out here, you know, we built into our model, I say it here, we assumed declining growth. We modeled out continued slowdown in China. We just wanted to devastate the industry even more. Our view was really, who will survive, who will make it, with the assumption of no pickup, if in fact maybe even continued substantial decline, and just who's going to really make it. And if anything, if a couple of these guys are going to have to raise money to survive to that point, who are the ones that we want to get into bed with and really be partners with here? And I think we've picked the ones that we feel the most comfortable. The fact is, once you move beyond dry bulk, you realize maritime-related investments, it's an enormous area. There's container ships, there's tankers, there's LNG, there's other things as well. And the fact is, this woke us up to look in other areas. On this presentation, I'm not going to get into the other areas except to say that we are seeing, our view is that even the container business now is probably where dry bulk was 18 months ago. Decimation, devastation. And our friends at our company, Navios, they recently bought some container ships and created a brand new company to manage those because they were buying it from a extremely distressed seller. But again, I don't want to go in that direction. That's a whole other hour. Let me see what else I got. Oh, there's me. And so that's basically where we are. But in summary, we think dry bulk, especially these 4 stocks, I'm going to go back to that page, that we own, are the best positioned. The 3 on the top here, they are not looking to exit sort of existence, but the one at the bottom, Songa, will not exist in a few years as events continue to move forward. A solid balance sheet company. They really run the business extremely well. Except for Navios, I think the other 3 companies have unbelievably strong balance sheet. I think Navios has a reasonably solid balance sheet. And it comes down to betting on who's the captain of the ship as well. The smart guys, the creative ones, the ones who understand how to take advantage of opportunities. Angeliki, who runs Navios, she's one of the most aggressive people in this industry. You know, just all of the guys that we've met through that process of elimination that we went through over quite some period of time got us down to this group. And so maybe I'll end on that and see if anybody has any questions.
Well, David, thank you so much for that fascinating presentation. Perhaps you could shed a little bit of color on some of the companies you passed on, and you don't have to necessarily name names, but talk about why you passed on them and kind of contrast it with the guys that you ended up investing with.
Sure. And I don't have a problem throwing a couple of names out there.
Sure.
There's a company, they're in the news all the time, Dry Ships. Stay away. Stay away. They've done more. I think just this year, Dry Ships has done maybe five or six reverse stock splits. They are a consumer of capital. The main owner somehow always seems to do extremely well. The shareholders do not. I think it's just been an absolute bad investment for any investors outside of sort of the insiders. But yet that's the one, because of the price volatility, that stock has moved enormous percentages in single days. Again, it's on the news, they talk about it all the time. I think the Heard on the Street column in the Journal did a story on Dry Ships, and but they also profiled people that were shareholders and how they were just wiped out. And so companies like that we're not interested in. I think there was one day it was up 1,000%. Yes, I'm not kidding you. And so then the next day it wasn't so good for the people who bought it up 1,000%. Also Genco Shipping, just another company that they're perennial capital raisers. And it's just, we find it very frustrating to try to get to know sort of what they're all about. At the end of the day, it's not just in these stocks, it's in everything that we do. I said it a few minutes ago, we're betting on the captain of these ships. I think of it sort of more broadly, we're not just buying horses, we're buying jockeys. And we have to not just believe in the quality and the judgment of the people that we're betting on, but we're also betting on the character. And if we, you know, there were bad managers, that's one thing. Bad, I'll just say bad people. I'm not likening the phrase bad people to any specific company. I'm just saying when we view people as of poor character, we're not interested. Jumping back to Genco for a moment, I just think it's a very hairy situation. There's just so many pieces. Normally, if it's very complex, we love it because we can deconstruct it and see if there's something at the core. With Genco, we're not sure what's at the core. Can't seem to find it. And so these are the ones that we like. There are other ones that are on the bench. We like Gary Vogel. He runs Eagle. I think he's done a great job there. And we don't own it. It's something that I would say, as I say, it's on the bench. It's something that we would look at. I think we have, even though we see other opportunities, there's tiny little companies like Seanergy. Their symbol SHIP, SHIP, as in Peter. Small company, just well run. We really like the people there. They know their assets well. They know what they're doing. We have to manage this. I have to take a step back when I own these names to make sure that they don't. And something like Seanergy, I think, is a 40 million market cap. So it's kind of small. The one thing I didn't say when I gave the overview of my firm is we manage today about $1.1 billion, of which approximately 600 million is in a '40 Act mutual fund. We're not a hedge fund. We don't get a carry or anything like that. So maybe you should tune out if you guys are charging performance fees. I'm not as smart as you guys. But we have a mutual fund, and then we do separate accounts. But at the end of the day, I think we bring something different to the mutual fund world than it normally has. But we have to be mindful of liquidity. I can do less liquid, which I've done here, but we have to cap the totality of the less liquids at a certain level. And at some point, we had to sort of say no to certain investments that we might have liked to do, but we have to be very mindful of sort of the total layout of the whole portfolio in terms of its characteristics. I think it's important to do that always.
A question on the capital allocation long term by these companies. They clearly raise capital. Do they ever return capital, let's say in good times or?
Well, So Scorpio will, their intention is to start to pay dividends, I think, pretty quickly. And I think, frankly, in our conversations with the different, well, Scorp, the ones at the, my barbells here, Scorpio and Songa. Songa is ultimately, while it's a new business that's less than a year and a half old, in the long run, it's a liquidation. Their whole existence is to get capital back to investors at the end. And the end is likely to be under 4 years. So it's a limited life existence for a public company. Scorpio, again, is turning the corner. They want to start paying dividends. I would tell you that this is not a business like tankers that are paying dividends and so forth. Here you're getting they are capital allocators in that they sell ships and buy ships, but getting the cash back to shareholders, it is now sort of part of their menu. I would say in talking to these guys, I think they've all been burned in the past, and we are tracking and monitoring and trying to hold them accountable to be disciplined. It's still so early in the process, but the fact is the banks are sort of up to their eyeballs here in these loans, and so they can't go back to the banks. They have to survive and prosper on their own. But as I say, it's slowly happening where key players in the industry are going to the point where they want to get distributions out to shareholders. And even Scorpio, I would tell you, I view them more as sort of just natural buyers and sellers than anything else. If there's any other company on this list that might not exist in a few years for a good reason besides Songa, it's going to be Scorpio. Because I think at the end of the day, Robert Bugbee, who's the president of the company, and the main owners, they're trying to make money, and I think they know this industry well. And we're aligned with them. So for them to make the most money, they have to do something to get the stock value up. And I think dividends is going to be the first step. But there are scenarios, you could model out crazy scenarios in these stocks where you get such ridiculous cash flow numbers with just modest improvements in sort of the day rates. They've tightened their cost control so much. They're managing very efficiently. They're not, the top guys are not siphoning off fees. In some of these companies, there's all kinds of weird fee arrangements. You know, we really focus on understanding how much is going for transactions and so forth to make sure that we will get capital allocated to us at the end of the day. Otherwise, this would be a waste of our time.
David, on the two companies that trade pretty much where you invested, so Navios and Songa, can you talk a little bit about the metrics, valuation and such around the capital raise?
Sure. Well, in the case of Songa, it was a capital raise with no assets, meaning the company was a new company raising capital to buy ships. And so we had to make a determination on the track record, the history, the backgrounds of the people. We did not come in on their first round. We wanted to see them buy some ships, see how disciplined they were on pricing and so forth. They were buying ships at, I think, percent of NAVs that were maybe, I'm thinking like 60, 65% of NAV kind of thing. They were getting attractively priced younger ships. So there's three main areas that you can get your ships from: Korea, Japan, China. Songa basically has no, I don't think you'll ever see them buy a Chinese ship. Why? Because the Chinese ships are perceived as a lesser quality product. They're cranking them out faster. Nobody can build as fast as the Chinese on these ships. And so there's some questionable issues with some of them. Some of them are starting to rust sooner than the ones from Japan or Korea. And so Songa has, from day one, has designed itself to, as I said before, they are in existence only to go out of existence, take advantage of an opportunity. In the case of Navios, we started buying it at $2.10. It promptly went to $1.55, I think. I think we were buying at just north of 80% of NAV. Their cash break even is amongst the lowest of all the groups. What we liked here was that we like the quality of their fleet. They also have some container ships in here. We think they're going to peel those out. Those will probably be sold. They will sell them to another Navios company. That's the container company. But that will bring cash into the Navios maritime business. The situation at Navios, I would say, was a little different in that this was a stock that was really, really decimated. And we came in a little later in the process than we did with some of these other companies. But the fact is that it's the quality of the ships, the quality of the management team, the quality of how they operate, it's solid and very high. So we are buying all of these at compelling discounts to their net asset value. They don't have to buy any more ships, but I will tell you, if the woman that runs Navios has a single weakness, it's that she can't help herself. And I mean that in a good way, which is when she comes across an interesting deal, she feels so compelled to take advantage of it because she firmly believes that the levels are so, how many more of these are you going to get in your lifetime? I think is the way she said it to us. And we agree with her. So we are looking at it from that standpoint. The way we allocate capital in our portfolio, we have to manage all of this. We don't want ever any more than 25% in any one sector. But in our fund, we probably have today about 15% in maritime, 15 or 16% in maritime related. And the fact is that the last thing I'll say about Navios is that what they have done is, so they bought 14 container ships into this company. And I think they, and we agreed with them, that it made sense to actually not do that. Buy them at the price they were buying them because it was from a distressed seller, but create a new Navios company, which is Navios Maritime Container. Put those 14 in, and eventually we'll put the other 7 in that they have today. So you'll have pure play, once dry bulk, once container. And I think it's funny, the market values each of these businesses very differently. And so ultimately, you want to get the best value. And as I say, the ones that we're focusing on and a few others are getting smarter. They're more savvy in how they invest, how they take advantage, how they think of returns on investment, time, the holding period. They look at everything now. They didn't do that in the past. These were just a bunch of guys in Greece in the old days and in Norway who just had capital and they'd buy ships, and you know, they were around for a long period of time and they kind of didn't focus enough on the metrics and the numbers, but yet they were mega wealthy families that did extremely well with almost just a gut feel, kind of until it didn't work. And now the view is to think about capital and returns and lockups and so forth. When they bought those containers, they bought them at scrap level. They literally were trading at the price of scrap steel. So that's when you want to be a buyer. If you could just melt something down and get the same price, I think it's generally not a bad time to take advantage of an opportunity. And so for us, we're pure opportunists. You know, my tagline, I have it underneath my logo. It says invest like owners. Yes, we take an owner's approach. Would we want to own this company as an owner? Would we want to own the whole thing? But if I had a second tagline, it would be to be pure opportunists. There are windows of opportunities. You got to take them. This is one that is, it's not a short window. There's a wide window here. But it really comes down to, in my view, betting on the right horse. Maybe all the horses will win the race. Sometimes the whole industry will work. But we have to have the quality of the assets and of the people and the character that we are comfortable part. We look at these investments as partnerships. Even though we're just equity owners, we view them as partners with us.
And David, maybe lastly, I will go back to what you mentioned earlier, dry bulk versus some of these other segments like tankers and container ships. And, you know, when you said that containers might be like dry bulk 18 months ago, that was a little bit like putting blood in front of a shark. So I'd love to just hear a little bit more on that and why you think that might be the case.
Sure. Well, look, overall container, first of all, container vessels, we're talking about the ships, not the actual containers, but the container ships also had gotten to the point where they were trading at, as I said, Navios was buying some at truly scrap level. And so, but at the same time, you see consolidation in the industry. You saw an enormous amount of scrapping again. So they scrapped ships, reducing the number of ships. You've seen, I'm trying to think of the big picture really. For example, there's a company called Hapag-Lloyd. So Hapag-Lloyd is a transportation company, but it owns container ships. They've done two mergers in the last 18 months. So they IPO'd about a year and a half ago. And of course, guess what happened after the IPO? The stock plummeted. The fact is they merged with a company, CSAV, which almost was the largest player in Chile. It almost, I think it doubled their assets. About a year ago, they announced a merger with the largest player in Egypt. I think it's USAV or UASC, sorry. Too many letters. That deal just closed earlier this year. We just met with management of Hapag-Lloyd in Germany 2 weeks ago. Love it. We love it. Why? Now, the stock isn't trading at the same level it was before. This is one of the few players that's done extremely well. But the fact is they tried to IPO themselves at $30, which we thought on an NAV basis was too high. They couldn't get it down. They did it at 20. We bought it on the deal. We usually don't buy IPOs. This was what I'll call a cold IPO. It wasn't cold enough, and it got even colder. Went down to 15. We added all the way down to 15. Today it's in the high 30s. We just saw the CEO in Munich, and you know, they're just consolidating the merger. There's so much fat when these companies merge. They're taking their costs down. They're restructuring. They also restructured their balance sheet. They took down all their high cost debt to low cost debt. Cash flows are building. Why? Because demand is starting to pick up again, and it's not off to the races. It's just little ticks up. So that's at the bigger end, a big player like a Hapag-Lloyd. Some of these other players that we're talking about, like Navios creating their container ship business, the fact is, again, they're buying for scrap level, and the signs of sort of the bottoming out has already sort of, we feel like we're just there. I'm not here to make market calls. In fact, if I ever start making market calls, just run away. But what we see are the signs that the pain, the environment has changed, because the scrapping process that I mentioned earlier, it's significant to the point where it's a game changer. Because now if you have a ship that's over 15 years old, you have to do certain tests and certain checks every year now that are so expensive that, guess what? They're just saying it's just, at some point, it's not economically viable at the current rates. What will always happen is the minute day rates start to pick up, the guys who were going to scrap start to slow down and wait. They have something called a survey inspection. It's extremely cost prohibitive. I mean, to jump back to dry bulk for a minute, One of the reasons why you're seeing scrapping is because sulfur emissions and scrubber, and you need a water ballast components that previous ships didn't need. Well, the water ballast could cost 500,000 to a million and a half. The sulfur emissions could be a minimum 3 million, as much as 5 million per ship. So that the older ships, forget it. I did jump back to dry bulk, but in the containers, similarly, the regulatory changes are such game changers. I know I'm going to run out of time, but I'm going to just tell you a quick 30-second John Fredrickson story. It has nothing to do with these two, but it's about tankers. 25 years ago, I met John Fredrickson for the first time. He came to New Jersey when I was working at a big mutual fund company. And he said, the industry's turning. You got to believe me. Here's why. And he laid it all out. And he was there with his old partner, Tor Olav Trøim. And I'm like, it sounds great, except for one thing. That's what he said last year. And so I kind of, gave him one of these waves, and I didn't give it a second thought. Yeah, over the next year, that was his first billion on his way to many billions. My point was, he was investing, he was taking advantage, he was doing all the things to take advantage of the environment while nobody would believe what was going on. And frankly, I talked to some of his people just recently, and sadly, they still tell the story about how I missed it. And so the fact is, we look at these, it doesn't mean we're going to just buy anything. But when we look at these other areas, whether it's containers, we do own a tanker company today. Everybody, you know what people hate more than anything right now? It's oil tankers. And so we've started to nibble there. We own Frontline. That is Fredrickson's company. Back when I first met him, he hadn't yet done the hostile bid to take control of Frontline. He was about to do it. So that stock's trading ridiculously cheap. Again, or I didn't say it, but we're not becoming a maritime fund. But what we are doing is seeing this opportunity. The more we dig, the more we saw the characteristics and the lessons that we could take away from dry bulk, which still has a viable opportunity. It brought us to containers. It brought us to tankers. We're not looking at LNG and the others. As I said, we're not going to become just a shipping and maritime fund by any stretch of the imagination. But when we see these situations where, by and large, investors are just puking the assets, to be blunt, they're dumping them, and you're in, and I'm going to use a bad word here, you're in a shit storm. The fact is, you have to take advantage of it, because otherwise, you look back and you say, I don't want to have two of those stories that I just told about John Fredrickson. I want to just be able to tell that one and then tell the one about how it all worked. And I see it there. We see it, but frankly, it's not just these businesses. Our assets have doubled in the last 8 or 10 months. Investors have invested more with us because we are finding more and more to do. Everybody talks about they can't find anything to do with markets at these levels, but it's stocks like this that are going through radical changes. It's conglomerates in Europe that are breaking up. It's M&A activity that's on fire. But it's also looking at mid-sized and smaller companies. All of these companies I've talked about today, they all have very, I don't think any one of them has over a billion market cap, if any, even close to that. That's the opportunity as well, is the mid and the smaller names. And so, because there's so many asset managers out there with so much money, and there's so much passive, think about this move to passive investing, a lot of value investors are sitting here waiting for their 50 cent dollars to be revalued, but there's nothing to revalue it. And the money that used to go into those stocks is going into indexes that are buying different so-called value stocks. Those guys have to wait for deals, which are probably coming anyway. But the fact is, you need to have catalysts, you need to have change, you need to have things that are going to get the value out of the stock and into the shareholders' hands. And that is exclusively where we put our effort in. And as I say, there's an abundance of it, but you still have these funds that have 5 billion, 10 billion, 20 billion. They can't look at any of these companies. So we have just less competitive environment. And so for us, it's a phenomenal period of time to be a value investor. And so that's the way I see it.
David, thank you so
Smile.
much. I was going to end it right there, but you brought up John Fredrickson and Frontline. And just a quick point on that. I think I remember a few years ago, Frontline actually took a whole bunch of ships out of that company and did some kind of a deal. And it may not have been the best situation for the minority shareholders that had been in Frontline at the time. Do you any color on that, and kind of you still feel like it's good a good place to be a passive shareholder alongside John Fredrickson in these companies?
Yes. So you're talking about Frontline. They created a company called Frontline 2012. Guess
Right.
what? It was in the year of 2012. And they basically were bailing out Frontline. They did take some high quality ships and move it into the other company. I think ultimately it's come back to, yes, at that point in time, I think Fredrickson, he was bailing out his company, but they created this new vehicle. I don't think that was the most shareholder friendly, but I do think at the same time, had he not done that, I don't think Frontline would exist today in its current form, meaning I don't think it would have made it. And so after that, there was a modest recovery. And I think today, though, so here's what, in my view, has happened. They understand that they took advantage of the shareholders. And the market kind of obviously didn't like it. We didn't either. We were looking at it back then, and we were just like, we're not going to invest in a company like this. Why now, 5 years later, am I interested in being alongside Fredrickson? Well, I think that they understand that they have to do the right thing for shareholders. I know they have Seadrill, which is filed for bankruptcy, but the fact is, if they continuously take advantage of shareholders, they will never trade at a premium again. Frontline, for many years, was the premium player. It traded above NAV. It was sort of the gold standard. And then you had the carnage in the industry, and they did take advantage of an opportunity. I don't know that the company would have existed if they didn't, but boy, maybe there was another way to do it where the shareholders could participate. I agree with you. I think since then they understand you can't burn your shareholders. They've implemented a remarkably changed corporate governance program. He brought in a new CEO. So the CEO of Frontline today is a young guy. I don't think he's 40 yet. Robert McLeod. I really like him. He came in from Glencore. He's aggressive. He's hungry. He's motivated. He works for Fredrickson, but he's trying to bring more of the, as I say, corporate governance, focus on making everybody a winner. We really look at companies where we think, who you have to ask a simple question, who's the winner here? And can everybody win? I don't care if the main owner wins as long as I'm participating with them. And I do believe that Frontline's gone through their own sort of metamorphosis because of going through, they've had a crisis in a number of areas, not just Frontline, I'm saying Fredrickson. And as a result, I think they're smarter operators today. And they're showing discipline. They talk about shareholder value more than ever before, not just distributing dividends. They were going to bid, they made a hostile bid on a company called DHT, another tanker business. I think they could have spent 30 million euros more and they could have won the day. And they said, no way. They were price sensitive, they were focused. I think that's a combination of Fredrickson, but I think it's also the new CEO being disciplined, thinking about capital allocation, thinking what's in the best interest for all shareholders. And so we've spent time with them to understand better how they think. And frankly, John, I asked the same question. Why should we have any faith in you? Aren't you just going to take advantage of the shareholders in the future? And so actions, of course, speak louder than anything else. And so, but I will say that the path that they've been taking since then, I believe, is a stronger path. And I do believe that Frontline is probably the best positioned company to take advantage of the decimation in tankers. And almost like Fredrickson did 25 years ago when he was first coming into it in a big way. they're looking at all kinds of opportunities to buy ships on the cheap, either private transactions, onesies and twosies, or bidding for companies, but making sure they get it at a price that accretes real value. And so I think we're a top five holder now of the company. The market cap there is less than a billion. It was once many billions. And so everybody's a little more humble in these industries than they ever were before. The problem is when they become successful again, what happens? The key is to make sure that they do stay humble. But I think ultimately we are tagging along on their coattails, and we should do extremely well for our investors and ourselves as investors in our own fund.
Great. Well, we could talk about this topic for hours, it seems, but we're going to have to leave it there. David, thank you so much once again for being with us and for sharing these truly tremendous insights.
Thank you for your time and everybody for listening. Really appreciate you including us in this.
And should any of you have further questions for David, I encourage you to get in touch or contact us, and we'll be happy to introduce you.
Great.
And with that, everybody, goodbye for now.